content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 22nd, 2013 edition of The Week magazine. And we start with the main stories and how they were covered. More trouble for Obamacare. What happened? The website providing access to the federal health care insurance exchanges may not be fully fixed by a self-imposed November 30th deadline, an Obama administration official admitted this week. As pressure mounted on the White House to allow people to keep individual policies that are now being canceled, the administration had promised the healthcare.gov site would be operational for a vast majority of users by the end of this month. But a source told the Washington Post that the site still freezes when 30,000 or more possible enrollees log on at the same time, just half its intended capacity. Publicly, administration officials said the site was already functioning much better and that the target date for the furious repair work hadn't changed. In October, the White House admitted, only 26,794 people bought private insurance plans in the 36 states relying on the federal website, with another 79,000 buying insurance through state exchanges. The administration had projected 500,000 would enroll in the first month. In Congress, several bills were submitted that would permit the 5% of Americans with individual insurance plans to keep policies that are being canceled under the law's new regulations. As many as 12 million Americans could lose the low-cost, low-coverage insurance plans bought in the individual market, despite Obama's repeated promise that anyone could keep plans they liked. Former Democratic President Bill Clinton urged Obama to fulfill that promise, even if it meant changing the law. The president should honor the commitment the federal government made to those people and let them keep what they got, he said. What the editorial said. The reality of Obamacare comes into sharper focus every day, said the Chicago Tribune, and it's not pretty. The website's technical problems will make it difficult for uninsured people to sign up by the December 15th deadline to receive coverage by January 1st. Hundreds of thousands have received cancellation notices for individual plans. In 2014, people with employer-provided insurance may also face unwelcome changes. Even if a digital SWAT team fixes the website, we need a complete congressional reimagining of the law. That's just not realistic, said the Washington Post. Trade-offs were always going to be part of health care reform, as the system depends on some healthier people paying more so that millions of sick and previously uninsured people can get coverage. No fix to the law could allow everyone to be a winner. Despite the political furor stirred up by the law's opponents, its goals remain both achievable and reasonable. High-quality health insurance available to all. What the columnist said. If the tech repair team doesn't meet the November 30th deadline, it creates huge political problems for the White House, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. Everything I've heard from insiders backs up the pessimists. But since the process of fixing the software is so complex, involving so many lines of code and interfaces with dozens of insurance companies, no one knows for sure when it will work smoothly. If most users can sign up starting in December, there's still time to minimize the damage, said Jonathan Kahn in NewRepublic.com. The initial enrollment numbers were bound to be low, As both the RomneyCare and Medicare Part D rollouts proved, few people rush to sign up for government programs at the beginning of enrollment. The statistics that really matter are the ones in December and beyond. As if Obama needed another problem, said Jonathan S. Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com, Bill Clinton just stuck a knife in the president's back. His suggestion that everyone should get to keep their existing coverage will only feed the uproar over canceled individual policies. The ground is slipping away from underneath the president's feet. This is why American politics is so dysfunctional, said Michael Cohen in the New York Daily News. Americans want progress and change, but without sacrifice or inconvenience. To sell health care reform to voters, Obama conveniently failed to mention that providing insurance to millions of people would require some disruption in the individual market. That played right into the hands of those who insist that centralized government power is an unqualified danger. Voters can't handle the truth, so instead, our leaders engage in endless political posturing. Our second main story, after the typhoon, chaos. Panic and desperation gripped parts of the Philippines this week after Super Typhoon Haiyan slammed into the island nation, killing at least 2,344 people and flattening everything in its path. With aid workers struggling to reach some of the worst-hit areas, around 11 million people were left without food, water, or shelter. The coastal city of Tacloban bore the brunt of the record-breaking 195-mile-per-hour winds and 13-foot storm surges. As it entered a fifth day without aid, President Benigno Aquino dispatched soldiers to contain widespread looting and violence. Thousands stormed the airport hoping to flee. No food, no water, no light, said Tacloban resident Mary Jane Garcia. We survived the typhoon, but this will kill us. The United Nations appealed for $301 million in aid, and the U.S. dispatched the aircraft carrier USS George Washington and other Navy ships to help the mammoth recovery effort. The Philippine government defended its slow response to the storm, which came weeks after a major earthquake. This is the largest logistic operation in the history of the Philippines, said one cabinet official. The disaster may be unprecedented for the Philippines, said Costas Sinolakis in WSJ.com. That's no excuse for the lack of preparation. Around 20 cyclones hit the country each year, and given this one's massive size, the sequence of events was predictable. Haiyan moved at a bicycle's pace, giving the government ample time to get organized. So why the chaos? Here's a simple explanation, said Max Fisher in WashingtonPost.com. Poverty. The Philippines ranks 165th in the world by GDP per capita, meaning residents can only afford light wood to construct their flimsy homes and supposedly stormproof shelters. That's why Haiyan wiped out whole areas in seconds, destroying roads and ports crucial to the delivery of local and international aid. Such storms will become even more devastating, said Adam Sobel in CNN.com. Global warming may be debatable, but rising sea levels are a fact. That will make flooding, Haiyan's deadliest weapon, as it was with Hurricane Sandy and Katrina, even deadlier in the future. Our controversy of the week, NFL bullying scandal, taking the measure of manhood. Imagine you started a new job, said David Horsey in the Los Angeles Times, and learned that you'd be ritually taunted by your coworkers, who might at any moment grab you and shave your head, or threaten to sexually assault your sister, or force you to pick up a $10,000 restaurant tab. You tell them to take this job and shove it. That's what Jonathan Martin, offensive lineman for the Miami Dolphins, effectively did last week, sparking a national debate over the NFL's juvenile version of manhood. The hazing of Martin, a soft-spoken classics major from Stanford, was led by thuggish veteran lineman Richie Incognito, who bombarded Martin with abusive messages, in one addressing the biracial Martin as a, quote, half nigger, and threatening to kill him, as well as defecate in his mouth. Perhaps most disturbing, said Christopher Gasper in the Boston Globe, is that most of Martin's teammates, including the African Americans, have since publicly sided with the suspended Incognito. By the Cro-Magnon canon of pro football, it's Martin who deserves contempt for breaking the locker room code of silence and failing to, quote, act like a man. The NFL isn't a genteel accounting firm, said Samuel Chi in RealClearSports.com. Like the military, it has its own culture, in which only those who are willing to inflict and absorb bodily harm can survive and thrive. Is it really so shocking that competitive alpha dogs who are paid to engage in legalized mayhem for the public's entertainment build their camaraderie in ways the rest of us find extreme? No one forced Martin to join this exclusive and well-paid club, said Stu Bukowski in Philly.com. In the NFL, hazing is a universal rite of passage, toughening the rookies and bonding players into a cohesive unit. Clearly, Martin is a wuss who's not mentally tough enough for the NFL. There's football's throwback culture in a nutshell, said Kate Fagan in ESPN.com. To be a man, you must be willing to absorb pain at all cost. You must never walk away from conflict. To admit weakness is to be female, and to be female is contemptible. Is it any wonder that bullying and sexual assault are rampant in a society that glorifies jocks? Look at what these attitudes are doing to the players themselves, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. Coaches and players have been caught offering cash bounties to teammates who injure opponents. The New England Patriots had to release star tight end Aaron Hernandez this year when he was charged with murder. Former players once praised for their toughness in shrugging off multiple concussions are now suffering an epidemic of degenerative brain disease. Sadly, those of us who grew up loving this brutal sport can no longer turn a blind eye to the wreckage. For that reason, the Incognito Martin bullying scandal may have done the country a favor, said Dave Zirin in TheNation.com. It's openly raised the question, what makes a man? Under the man code that prevails in both football and the larger society, a man cannot ever admit he's in psychological pain. He must respond to problems with either stoic silence or aggression. Trapped in this emotionally stunted role, men are far more likely to be alcoholics and abusers than women, and 3 to 4 times as likely to take their own lives. Do we really want our sons to think a real man is a bar-fighting, woman-groping blockhead like Incognito? Now's a good time to talk about it. It was a good week for singles, after a Chinese website launched a new rent-a-boyfriend service, so young women can take home fake beaus and stop parental nagging about finding a husband. It was a good week for comebacks, after Philadelphia voters elected a Whig, W-H-I-G, to public office for the first time in 157 years, Robert Buchholz, who was elected to be a ward election judge, said the nation badly needed a third party that stood for pragmatic compromise. And it was a good week for freak shows. After hundreds of people lined up at Toronto's City Hall to buy a signed, limited edition bobblehead doll of Mayor Rob Ford, who recently admitted to smoking crack cocaine. "We're living in crazy times," said one local, who waited 3 hours to get a Ford doll. It was a bad week for the face of Obamacare. After the smiling woman whose photo appeared on the homepage of healthcare.gov said she had been subjected to fierce cyberbullying. "I didn't design the website," said Adriana, who refused to give her surname, "so I don't think they should have any reasons to hate me." It was a bad week for theology after Sarah Palin expressed her disapproval of Pope Francis, saying he's taken me aback with his statements, which she described as, quote, "kind of liberal," end quote. It was a bad week for racists after a white supremacist who intends to set up an Aryan enclave in North Dakota took a DNA test on a TV show and discovered he's 14% African. The show's black host gave the horrified Craig Cobb a fist bump and called him bro. We take a look now at the briefing page. The antibiotics crisis. Drug-resistant superbugs that kill people are on the rise, but no new antibiotics are in the pipeline. Why not? Why are antibiotics so important? Without them, modern medicine would not be possible. Arguably, the most important factor in the 30-year jump in American life expectancy in the 20th century, these wonder drugs allow us to fight the whole gamut of bacterial illness, from everyday ear infections to diseases such as syphilis, typhoid, and tuberculosis that used to kill millions of people. Their discovery about 100 years ago also revolutionized the world of surgery. As antibiotics drastically reduced the number of post-operative infections, standard operations that used to be considered perilous, such as appendix removals, became safe and routine. But as life expectancy climbed, Alexander Fleming, who discovered penicillin, sounded an alarm. "There is the danger," he said in his 1945 Nobel Prize acceptance speech, "that the ignorant man may easily underdose himself, and by exposing his microbes to non-lethal quantities of the drug, make them resistant." Was he right? Yes, unfortunately. Thousands of Americans are now dying every year from infections that used to be curable. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently warned that drug-resistant bacteria kill at least 23,000 people annually in America and cost the U.S. healthcare system $20 billion a year. Three nightmare superbugs, the CDC says, have become of urgent concern. The crisis has become so pressing that CDC official Dr. Arjun Srinivasan has warned that we could be entering a post-antibiotic era. If that proves true, the repercussions would be devastating. Treatments we take for granted, like organ transplants, premature infant care, and chemotherapy, which weakens the patient's immune system, would be put in jeopardy. Even routine medical procedures like the placement of a catheter would be considered too dangerous. In a post-antibiotic world, said Margaret Chan, Director General of the World Health Organization in 2012, things as common as strep throat or a child's scratched knee could once again kill. How did superbugs develop? Through evolution. Over time, Some bacteria develop genetic mutations that make them immune to antibiotics used against them. When a particular type of antibiotic is used again and again, those tougher resistant bacteria survive while their susceptible counterparts die off. Eventually, the resistant bacteria begin to outnumber the vulnerable bacteria and, in effect, take over, rendering that particular generation of antibiotic ineffective. That gives rise to infectious diseases that can't be treated. Though this process is natural, humans have accelerated it enormously. How are we making it worse? As Fleming feared, antibiotics are being widely misused. Fully half of human antibiotic use is inappropriate, estimates the CDC. A lot of people underuse antibiotics, stopping their treatment as soon as they start feeling better, before all the target bacteria are killed off, leaving the tougher residual microbes to grow and spread. But by far the worst negligence comes through overuse. Too many patients demand antibiotics from their doctors, even if they have viral illnesses that these drugs can't treat, such as the common cold or the flu. Though only 10% of adults with sore throats have a bacterial infection, doctors prescribe antibiotics in about 60% of sore throat cases. Factory farms make even more profligate use of antibiotics. A staggering 80% of the antibiotics sold in this country are fed to farm animals to plump them up and keep them alive in their overcrowded habitats. This practice exposes vast armies of bacteria to antibiotics, making them more and more resistant. Why not just develop new antibiotics? Pharmaceutical companies say that it's too expensive. Antibiotics require billions of dollars to develop, but people usually take them for just a few days, with a single course of most antibiotics selling for a few hundred dollars. Including the cost of discovery and development, the average new antibiotic loses $50 million, according to the Federal Office of Health Economics. Drug companies can make billions, however, developing medications for chronic diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, which are taken by patients for the rest of their lives. As a result, there have been no major new antibiotics since 1987. We're losing ground because we're not developing new drugs in pace with superbugs' ability to develop resistance to them, said Helen Boucher from the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Can this crisis be solved? It can, but only if pharmaceutical companies are given sufficient financial incentive to create new antibiotics. Last year, Congress passed the GAIN Act, hoping to encourage new antibiotic development. The law extends patents for new antibiotics so that inventors can maximize their profits before generics get in on the game, and fast-track approval for antibiotics that target certain pathogens. But the industry says the new law is only a first step. Companies are urging Congress to approve tax credits to help cover the cost of research and development. Even if new antibiotics are eventually developed, the problem will reoccur unless livestock farmers stop pumping their animals full of antibiotics and doctors and patients stop misusing the drugs for non-bacterial illnesses. The alternative, said Chan, is the end of modern medicine as we know it. And here are the best columns from the U.S. The first comes from Robert Samuelson of the Washington Post. The Enduring Illusion of JFK. At best, John F. Kennedy was a mediocre president, said Robert Samuelson. That's an unpopular thing to say as we approach the 50th anniversary of his assassination, and we are deluged by essays, books, and a movie paying tribute to the great romantic myth of Camelot. JFK's magnetic charm and lofty rhetoric endeared him to a generation. But Kennedy's actual record was unimpressive. At his death, he had no major legislative accomplishments. His two biggest proposals, civil rights legislation and a tax cut, languished in Congress. On foreign affairs, Kennedy fared no better. He expanded the Vietnam War, made a complete mess of the Bay of Pigs, and got pushed around by Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev until the dangerous nuclear face-off of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Tragically, the most consequential moment of Kennedy's presidency was his assassination. It so filled the country with grief and guilt that his successor, Lyndon Johnson, who was finally able to push the tax cut and civil rights legislation through Congress. As we mourn the lost promise of JFK, let's remember it was only a promise. From Steve Chapman at the Chicago Tribune, a hard lesson about war. By now you'd think our nation would understand the limits of American military power, said Steve Chapman. Yet even after the U.S. recent misadventures in the Middle East, hawks are clamoring for new wars in the region, promising that attacks on Syria and Iran will be quick, low risk, and ordained to succeed. But consider Iraq, where the U.S. 9 years of war and thousands of casualties have left the country back where it was before the 2007 surge, engulfed in bloody chaos. In the sectarian violence sparked by a rekindled Al-Qaeda rebellion, an average of 20 citizens are massacred every day. In Afghanistan, we've waged war for 12 years, and we're still bogged down fighting jihadists. President Hamid Karzai's regime is rotten with corruption, and the Taliban are primed to stage a comeback when our troops withdraw next year. Since we intervened in Libya and helped depose dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi, the country has become a failed state, a lawless haven for terrorists. In all three foreign interventions, victory became a brief mirage on the way to defeat. Remember that next time you hear a hawk promising victories in Syria and Iran. And from Juan Williams of The Hill, the GOP's futile culture war. Social issues are killing Republicans at the ballot box, said Juan Williams. GOP candidate Ken Cuccinelli lost by just 3 points in this month's Virginia gubernatorial race only because of his outspoken opposition to abortion, birth control, and gay marriage. On the top two issues, the economy and health care, voters actually sided with him. But his Democratic rival, Terry McAuliffe, hit Cuccinelli early and hard on his hardline pro-life stance, constantly reminding voters of Cuccinelli's opposition to abortion, even in cases of rape and incest, and of his support for forcing women seeking abortions to undergo physically invasive transvaginal ultrasounds. As a result, McAuliffe won 67% of the votes of single women, a deciding factor in the race. In 2012 contest for the U.S. Senate, Republican anti-abortion crusaders Richard Murdoch and Todd Akin were likewise defeated, costing the GOP seats it should have won. Outside the deep red states, the culture war is over. To have any chance in swing states and national elections, Republicans can no longer afford to take extremist stances on social issues and ignore the views of millions of unmarried female voters. Our last word article today is titled Invisibly Wounded. About 500,000 Americans who went to Afghanistan and Iraq, said David Finkel, came home with PTSD. Adam drops the baby. The baby, who is 4 years old, 4 days old, is his son. And there is a moment as he is falling that this house he has come home to seems like the most peaceful place in the world. Outside is the cold dead of 3 a.m. on a late November night in Kansas, but inside is lamplight, the warm smell of a newborn, and Adam's wife, Saskia, beautiful Saskia, who a few minutes before had asked her husband if he could watch the baby so she could get a little sleep. I got it, he had said. She curled up in the middle of their bed, and the last thing she glimpsed was Adam reclined along the edge, his back against the headboard, and the baby in his arms. He was smiling, as if contentment for this wounded man were possible at last. And she believed it enough to shut her eyes, just before he shut his. His arm soon relaxed, his grip loosened. The baby rolled off his chest and over the edge of the bed. And here came that peaceful moment, the baby in the air. Then the moment is over and everything that will happen is underway. Saskia is the one who hears it. It is not loud, but it is loud enough. Her eyes fly open. She sees Adam, closed-eyed and empty-armed, and only when he hears screaming and feels the sharp elbows and knees of someone scrambling across him does he wake up from the sleep he had promised he didn't need. It takes him a second or two. Then he knows what he has done. He says nothing. There is nothing he can say. He is sorry. He is always sorry now. He has been sorry for 2 years, ever since he slunk home from the war. He dresses and leaves the room. He sits for a while in the dark, listening to her soothe the baby, and then he goes outside, gets into his pickup truck, and positions a shotgun so that it is propped up and pointed at his face. In that way, he starts driving, while back at the house, Saskia is trying to understand what happened. This baby, so resilient, breathing evenly, not even a mark, somehow fine. How can that be? But he is. Maybe he is one of the lucky ones, born to be okay. 2 years. He is 28 now, is out of the army, and has gained back some weight. When he left the war as the great Sergeant Schumann, he was verging on gaunt. 25 pounds later, he is once again solid, at least physically. Mentally, though, it is still the day he headed home. Emery, shot in the head, is still draped across his back. And the blood flowing out of Emery's head is still rivering into his mouth. Doster, whom he might have loved the most, is being shredded again and again by the roadside bomb on the mission Adam was supposed to have been on too. And after Doster is declared dead, another soldier is saying to him, "None of this would have happened if you were there." It was said as a soldier's compliment. Adam had the sharpest eyes. Adam always found the hidden bombs. Everyone relied on Adam. But that wasn't how he heard it then, or hears it now. It might as well have been shrapnel, the way those words cut him apart. It was his fault. It is his fault. The guilt runs so deep it defines him now. He's always been such a good guy, people say of Adam. He's the one people are drawn to, who they root for. Smart, decent, honorable, good instincts, that one. And now? I feel completely broken, Adam says. He's still a good guy, is what Saskia says. He's just a broken good guy. It's not as if he caused this. He didn't. It's not as if he doesn't want to get better. He does. On other days, though, it seems more like an epitaph. And not only for Adam. All the soldiers he went to war with, the 30 in his platoon, the 120 in his company, the 800 in his battalion, came home broken in various degrees, even the ones who were fine. I don't think anyone came back from that deployment without some kind of demons they needed to work out, one of the soldiers who was with Adam says. Constant nightmares, anger issues, and any time I go into a public place, I have to know what everyone is doing all the time, another of them says. Depression. Nightmares of my teeth falling out, another says. Other than that, though, the one who might be in the best shape of all says with an embarrassed laugh, after mentioning that his wife tells him he screams every night as he falls asleep. He sounds bewildered by this, as do they all. 2 million Americans were sent to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Home now, most of them describe themselves as physically and mentally healthy. They move forward. Their war recedes. Some are even stronger for their experience. But then there are others for whom the war endures. Of the 2 million, studies suggest that 20 to 30% have come home with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. A mental health condition triggered by some type of terror or traumatic brain injury, TBI, which occurs when a brain is jolted so violently that it collides with the inside of the skull and causes psychological damage. Depression, anxiety, nightmares, memory problems, personality changes, suicidal thoughts, every war has its after-war, and so it is with the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan, which have created some 500,000 mentally wounded American veterans. He doesn't believe anything is wrong with him. That's part of it. At home, he stares at himself in a mirror, ignores what his red eyes look like, except to see with continuing regret that he still has two of them. Does the inventory. Two eyes, two ears, two arms, two legs, two hands, two feet. Nothing missing. Symmetrical as ever. He is physically unmarked. So how can he be injured? The answer must be that he isn't. So why was he sent home with a diagnosis of severe PTSD? The answer must be that he's weak. So why was that diagnosis confirmed again and again once he was home? Why does he get angry? Why does he forget things? Why is he jittery? Why can't he stay awake, even after 12 hours of sleep? Why is he still tasting Emery's blood? Because he's weak. Because he's a pussy. Because he's a piece of blank. Saskia found the house and bought it during Adam's final deployment, the one that wrecked him. This was where they would claim the life they both had expected to have by his enlisting in the Army. House, kids, dogs, yard, money, stability, predictability. She knew he was coming home ill, but she also knew that he would be better once he was away from the war and back with her, that just by her presence he would heal. That fairy tale homecoming is how she thought of it. Everybody's happy, kind of like it never happened kind of thing. When he got home and wasn't happy, she told him she understood. And when he said he wasn't ready to be around a lot of people, she understood that too. Her patience, she had decided, would be bottomless. Saskia decorated the bedroom with a wall stenciling that said, "Always kiss me goodnight." He did. Then, dulled by prescriptions for anxiety and depression and jitteriness and exhaustion and headaches, he didn't. And then she didn't either, not always, and gradually less than that. Now they are on their way to the VA hospital in Topeka, 60 miles to the east, for a doctor's appointment. The war left him with PTSD, depression, nightmares, headaches, tinnitus, and mild traumatic brain injury, the result of a mortar round that dropped without warning out of a blue sky and exploded close enough to momentarily knock him silly. Between his government disability check of $800 a month and his $36,000 a year salary from a job he managed to find, he is pulling in about two-thirds of what he made in the Army. It has been 8 years since they met. This was in Minot, North Dakota. She was just out of high school, a girl who never missed curfew and was now on her own in a cheap basement apartment. And one day she emerged from the basement to the side of a local boy with a rough reputation sitting in the sun without a shirt. What Adam saw was a girl staring at him whose beauty seemed a counterpoint to everything in his life so far. And that was that. For both of them. Soon came marriage, and now here they are. Sometimes after they fight, she counts his pills to make sure he hasn't swallowed too many, and checks on the guns to make sure they're all there. The thought that he might not recover, that this is how it will be, makes her sick with dread sometimes. And the thought that he might kill himself leaves her feeling like her insides are being twisted until she can't breathe. The truth is that he has been thinking about killing himself, more and more, but he hasn't said anything to her, or to anyone, not lately. Because what would be the point? How many psychiatrists and therapists has he talked to? How many times has he mentioned it? And where has it gotten him? You have suicidal thoughts. You reported daily thoughts of suicide with a plan and a means. However, you repeatedly denied intent to harm yourself due to care for your family, was one psychiatrist's report, which went on to note, you have the ability to maintain minimum personal hygiene. Well, at least there's that, Adam thought, when he came across the report. Crazy, but clean. He found it when he was going through papers to see what he might need to bring with him to the VA. His medical file is thick and repetitive and soon bored him, and he turned his attention to several boxes filled with letters that he and Saskia had written to each other while he was overseas. Love letters, all. They wrote to each other just about every day. That's how they were. He read a few, and when they started making him a little sad over what had been lost between them, he moved on to other boxes. At the hospital now, Adam goes into the doctor, preceded by all of the previous histories dictated about him over these 2 years. Saskia waits outside. Sometimes she goes in with him, sometimes not. She is sure she knows what the doctor will say. Adam is wounded. Adam is ill. Adam needs to stay on his medication. Adam deserves the thanks of a grateful nation. This is excerpted from Thank You for Your Service by Daniel Finkel. On the Health and Science page, the galaxy is full of Earth-like planets. Astronomers have calculated that there are 11 billion possibly inhabitable planets in our galaxy, providing compelling new grounds to believe we're not alone in the universe. With tens of billions of these water-laden Earth-sized planets, surely some of them have all the necessary attributes of life, University of California, Berkeley astronomer Jeffrey Marcy tells Bloomberg.com. The discovery puts our beautiful home planet into a cosmic perspective and gives us knowledge about our place in our galactic community. The research team used 4 years of data from NASA's now-retired Kepler Space Telescope to compute how many planets lie in the Goldilocks zone of their solar systems, where surface temperatures are neither too hot nor too cold to support liquid water. They focused on a corner of the Milky Way containing 42,000 stars, watching for the signature dimming that occurs when a planet passes before a star to calculate what percentage of stars have planets. Then they extrapolated that figure to the 200 billion stars that make up the Milky Way galaxy. The results? About 1 in 5 sun-like stars harbors a roughly Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone, and the nearest is perhaps only 12 light-years away, close enough for a possible exchange of communication. Even if the conditions that produce life, let alone intelligent life, are very rare, the sheer number of planets would suggest that we have plenty of company. The Milky Way is just one of billions of galaxies, so if you consider the entire universe, the possibility of intelligent life seems quite high. Reading a wagging tail. A dog's tail wagging sends two distinctly different messages, a new study has found. Italian researchers say that the direction of the wagging is an automatic response triggered by activity in the brain's two hemispheres, offering evidence that dogs, like humans, have asymmetrically organized brains. The study builds on work by the same team that found dogs wag their tails to the right when seeing something positive, like their owners, and to the left upon encountering threats, like an unfriendly dog. This time, 43 dogs of various breeds were outfitted with vests that monitored their heart rate and then shown videos of other dogs in which the only moving object was the tail. The dogs that watched a left wagging tail became anxious and experienced an accelerated heart rate, while the ones that viewed a rightward wag stayed calm and even began to approach the dog on screen. University of Trento neuroscientist Giorgio Valoritegara tells NPR.org that veterinarians, pet owners, and even mail carriers may profit from knowing when a dog is feeling friendly, and when approaching, one may evoke a more aggressive response. Wasting disease hits starfish. A strange disease is killing starfish in record numbers on the West Coast, the Los Angeles Times reports. Known as sea star wasting syndrome, its symptoms typically begin with white lesions on a starfish's limbs and then spread inward, causing the animal to disintegrate in less than a week. They essentially melt in front of you, says marine biologist Pete Ramiondi of the University of California, Santa Cruz. A previous flare-up caused significant starfish die-offs in 1983 and 1984, and again in 1997 and 1998. But the current outbreak extends farther than ever, from southeast Alaska to Orange County, California. It's pretty spooky because we don't have any obvious culprit for the root cause, even though we know it's likely caused by a pathogen, Raimondi says. If the outbreak continues, it could mean that the mussels the starfish eat may crowd out other species in tidal communities. We just don't know how bad it's going to get, Raimondi says. And one of our talking points, trans fats, going, gone. Start hoarding donuts, says Scott Shackford in Reason.com. The Food and Drug Administration is finally banning trans fats. This artificially produced lard substitute, made by using hydrogen to thicken vegetable oil, transformed our processed foods, extending the shelf life and improving the taste and texture of countless staples, including donuts, microwave popcorn, frozen pizza, and canned cake frosting. problem was, trans fats also happen to be amazingly bad for you, said Aaron Carroll in CNN.com. Not only do these artery cloggers increase our levels of bad cholesterol, but they actively lower your level of good cholesterol, too. By announcing its intention to blacklist trans fats last week, essentially eradicating them from our diets altogether, the FDA will prevent about 20,000 heart attacks and 7,000 deaths from cardiovascular disease annually. Goodbye, trans fats, and good riddance. Of course, trans fats are unhealthy, said Helena Bautamiller-Evich in Politico.com. But so are saturated fats. In fact, hydrogenated products like margarine were promoted as health foods in comparison to their saturated counterparts, like butter and coconut oil. Now we're told they're actually worse for us and that companies should replace them. But what's to say scientists won't reverse their opinion again in 10 years' time? Meanwhile, banishing trans fats from the food supply could have unintended consequences. America's favorite snacks won't last as long on grocery store shelves. They could be more expensive and they might not taste as good. This is what our nanny state government does now, day in, day out, says Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. It tells you what to eat and to do since it assumes you are stupid. The trans fat ban is hardly an assault on human liberty, said Kathleen O'Brien in the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. Food manufacturers have already cut the artery-clogging culprit out of their products by almost 75% since 2006, when the FDA required food labels to provide a breakdown of fats. Even McDonald's and KFC have already stopped using trans fats in their fried foods. But relax, America. The few remaining companies using them will not suddenly start making donuts out of kale or frozen pizza out of quinoa flour. They'll simply substitute other fat. Your Oreos, Chips Ahoy's, and Pringles will still be fatty, calorific, and unhealthy. So it's unlikely consumers will go into trans fat withdrawal. Church and state, where's the line? Before every town board meeting in Greece, New York, a Christian clergy member would invite the public to join in a prayer, said Jesse McKinley in the New York Times. Standing at a lectern with the town seal, the speakers would invoke Christ, the Holy Spirit, and our Savior. And when the prayer ended, board members would say Amen in chorus. Two local activists, a Jewish woman and an atheist, have challenged those prayers on the grounds that they violated the Constitution's prohibition on government establishment of religion. And last week, the case went before the Supreme Court. A critical distinction is at stake here, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Religion has always played an important role in American life. And as long as no one is compelled to participate, the Constitution does not prohibit public prayer. If it did, the Supreme Court would not open each session with God Save the United States of America and this honorable court. But in the context of a town board meeting, said Barry Lynn in the Washington Post, the pressure to pray is powerful. If a Jewish woman comes before a board to request a zoning variance for her small business, she might alienate board members by refusing to take part in a Christian prayer. What attorney would counsel a client to make herself known as a person not going along with the crowd as she, moments later, seeks special help from that body? Many Christians shrug off such public prayers as no big deal, said Jeff Schweitzer in HuffingtonPost.com. But how would they feel if a town meeting opened exclusively with an Islamic prayer from the Quran? The answer is obvious. It would be offensive and clearly counter to the ideal of religious freedom. This church-state issue has divided, confused, and angered Americans for decades, says Tom Krattenmacher in USA Today. And the Supreme Court is unlikely to come up with a tidy and final resolution. The Constitution offers vague clues as to where the line between church and state must be drawn, but no definitive answers, especially for a nation far more diverse than it was in the 18th century. That leaves us to apply some resources that seem in short supply today: reasonableness, respect, and consideration for people with ideas and beliefs different from your own. A few notes here. The amount of gun violence in PG-13 movies has more than tripled since 1985, according to a new study in the Journal of Pediatrics. In 2012, in fact, there was more such violence in PG-13 films than in R-rated movies. Violence sells, said study author Daniel Romer. The Navy this week christened its newest aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford, the first of a new class of nuclear-powered ships that use electromagnetic force to catapult planes off the deck. The $13 billion ship, which is $2 billion over budget, is the most expensive warship ever. A team of Dutch linguists has identified the word "huh" as universally understood across five continents. In 10 languages, including Dutch Mandarin, the Ghanaian language Siwu, and an Australian Aboriginal language, "huh" is used as a request for clarification. Well, huh, how about that? Here's a quote for you. No matter how smart you thought you were actually way less smart than that. From David Foster Wallace. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.